You're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, my name is Sue Nelson, and for the next hour we're going to be talking about all things food. I'm joined by my fellow presenter Guy Routledge of the Food Wrath as usual, and guess what, Guy? Somebody's turned up who hasn't been here for a little while.
Yeah, long time no see. Welcome back, Ollie Lloyd.
Thank you, it's good to be back. Apologies.
Have you been on your travels?
It's just been a crazy couple of weeks, yeah. Months, actually.
Yeah, a couple of months.
I was going to say, you haven't been on the programme for about 10 weeks.
I know.
So we've got you back. Your dulcet tones are very,
we have
very
a full
exciting.
House today. Very
we
exciting.
We have got a full house today. So we've got three guests in the studio, and then we've got another guest later on, and we couldn't wedge them all in. So we're going to do a sort of first half of the programme with Kimberly Hurd of Table, Joanna Becker and Marta Cesar from... Is it IFIS?
Yes, that right?
Good. Yeah. And then in the second half of the programme, we're going to speak to the lovely Tessa Stewart. I've got loads and loads of questions to ask her. So, first of all, have you been on Table at all?
I have. We've actually done a bit of work with Table over at the Food Rush. We've done some recipe sharing and some content collaboration, and we're planning a few other things for the new year. So,
So Kimberly,
we go way back.
Yeah. Do you want to explain exactly what Table is?
Sure. Yes, sure. So a Table is an online marketplace and community focused on helping build craft brands and craft food across the UK.
And when I go on there, it's got all sorts of really nice types of products that I really, really like. Mm. And in a way, I guess it aggregates for me in essence, because, I mean, how many products has Ocado got now? I mean,
millions, surely.
Literally hundreds. It's too much, and you can't actually find what you want.
Yeah, food discovery is a really challenging thing because
that's what it's called, food discovery.
I believe that's the term, isn't
it? You're so trendy.
Yeah. See, I've been doing my research. Mm-hmm. There's so many products out there, and so many that we've had the fortune to taste on this program and to meet at various trade shows and what have you. But there's still many more out there, and we're all looking for the new and interesting next delicious thing, and platforms like Table are a great place to go to find them.
So what's your criteria, Kimberly, for allowing people to be on it? Because I know you heavily curated.
Yeah, no, so we originally started actually to solve this, what I always like to call the page 20 problem. So for instance, if you went into Amazon and if you type in milk, you get 1,000+ search results. And then how you narrow it down is actually the same way you buy, a tire or, any commoditized product online. And that's actually not the way people discover food. And the way people discover food is actually through conversations, through people, by getting to know the person behind the product, the origin story. And there's not one place to go for that. And that's actually how we started Table and sort of thinking about who are the people behind the food. And I spent, an exhaustive amount of, 20 kilos of research, essentially, going around and going to as many supper clubs, pop-ups, farmers markets.
It's a tough life. It's a tough job, yeah.
Yeah. And it was really interesting because I realized actually, the people who were behind the food were actually food entrepreneurs. So these were people who weren't just at a farmer's market selling one product. They're also people who enjoyed entertaining or they enjoyed, having a cooking class. And they didn't have one place to go for their brand and for their business. And also I, as someone who was very much into craft food, didn't have one place I could go to discover if I was looking to make myself an interesting recipe, as we've collaborated with Guyon, or if I wanted to purchase, or if I wanted to go experience. So that's how we started Table. And our selection criteria originally was we were going and approaching brands that we were really inspired by. And we've spent the last year essentially building out our marketplace so it's fully automated, and so that now anyone in 2018 will be able to come on and sell, essentially open up a digital shop within 24 hours and sell their food online.
And Ollie from Great British Chefs, in your research and with all the chefs that you work at, do you actually find that this plethora of choice is becoming a problem? It's almost too much choice,
I think there's a regional bias on this. I think, one of the things one needs to start with is that, only 20% of foodies are based in London. So I think as you head way beyond London, you start to get, a diminishing return of choice. Mm. Obviously, you have more farm shops and you'll have more sort of, there's still the local delicatessens and stuff. But I think where where some of the tech platforms come in is actually where they can reach those people and offer them that choice that, you know, if one drives around the city of London, you can probably pretty much pick up anything. Whereas actually, if you're further afield, it's a bit more challenging.
I was thinking more of the online sort of choices, really. I don't even know where to go online now to get stuff, because this is too much almost. Well, and we have loads and loads of people here on the programme. I think, oh, God, I must buy that stuff with these guys that are on the programme. Now I think, oh, where do I get it?
Well, I mean, there's one thing with the online supermarkets, but a lot of the things that we're talking about, and especially a lot of the things that are on table, they're not in the major online retailers. And some of them actually will sell themselves direct, you know, via their own websites. But they have this this issue of not being visible enough. So, you know, like we've interviewed some really fantastic brands, but, you know, they're probably only getting a very small amount of traffic to their website. So directly, they're only selling a very small number of products.
Mm. I think what you find is that brands, you know, once they if they can really own a niche, you know, once consumers find them, they will do something extraordinary, which is do one shop at that brand website in order to get that product. And I think, you know, that's sort of, I suppose, one of the challenges to solve here is to be such a kind of category killer, whatever sort of mini vertical you're in, and provide, you know, the best range of Mexican chilies or the best range of ham on online, whatever it happens to be, and actually then become a destination. But the truth is, discovery is the difficulty.
Yeah, how do you find them in the first place?
Yeah, and even how do you get to master that one vertical? So, I mean, there's something to say. So firstly, getting onto a grocery shelf, I mean, for every SKU you see, there are 1,000 to 2,000 products that applied essentially to be in that place. Online, again, it's a question of noise. I mean, it's incredibly fragmented online. And so how do you master SEO, social media, paid search? Most of us, you know, I mean, I personally am not, you know, a digital expert, but, you know, I have to sort of work hard to make sure our platform is optimized for it. So, you know, you can end up wasting a lot of time and money, especially as a small business. And that's this market. So 96% of food businesses are SMEs, and they employ about 400,000 people here in the UK. And how do you stand out? And the truth is, most don't. So there are 45 new products that are launched every day in the UK. And then literally in a couple of years, so 90% of those won't exist. So it's highly biased, actually, for large businesses and brands to win, which is actually why I'm fighting, you know, to make sure there's one place for consumers to go and for businesses to go to actually find their footing and their voice, to be able to open up a digital business online, you know, for no money whatsoever.
So if somebody has got an amazing product and they want to be their own boss, in essence, they can come to you. Is this what you're trying to build at the moment?
So exactly.
So it's a bit like, is it a bit like Not on the High Street, you know, in you know, that people can actually use your platform, not have to go to the expense, not have to really understand the technical issues, and can literally open up online amongst another community of foodie food,
exactly
food
that
producers.
But we actually allow, so there are two things that are a bit different than, for instance, a Not on the High Street. So one, we're only focused on food and targeting people who like food. So there's a ready-baked audience and community that, pardon the pun, is hungry for, you know, new and interesting food to be inspired. The second thing is we actually have a community for our sellers. So we connect our sellers together to make sure they have the tools they can help solve, they can ask the questions, to be the best businesses, and that they're not in this alone. I can say, as you know, a solo founder, it's incredibly lonely and hard. So it's best to really sort of connect people together who are in the same place and fighting the same battles. And third, we actually allow our sellers to directly connect with their own customers. So Not on the High Street, many of these other platforms, actually, they sit in between the sellers. So they're no better than basically an online retailer. Mm. What we want people to do is have their own online digital shop, their own website. They can tell their story and sell all of their products in one place.
So they can have their own personality.
Yeah, which is so important. And do they also get access to, like, customer data so that they can keep in touch with them and build their own kind of mini community and you know, build their own brand online?
Absolutely. So, I mean, again, I mean, we really just want, you know, a business to be successful. So, for instance, even things like margin, we think about margin first, right? So there's no upfront fee to come onto table. So we want to provide you all of the service. And the only money we take is success-based. And it's basically just to cover our payments. So the cost of making a payment on the platform. And versus retailers where, you know, if you spend a pound in a large retailer, less than 10% of that actually goes to the seller. We very much reverse that. So it's 5%. We charge 5% for any event ticket sales and 20% for the products on the site. So everything goes back to the sellers.
So I've got an amazing food products I'm really proud of, and I really think I've got the taste right. I can come onto your platform and this gives me, you know, so somewhere I can shout about what I'm doing. Just turning now to my other two guests. What about all the health and safety and all the other, you know, legal requirements of a business? It's fine being on your kitchen table, but as soon as you get a little bit further than that, that there is a plethora of things you really do have to conform to, isn't there?
Well, it actually starts at the farm. It goes to that level. And a bit with the concept that Kimberly is talking about, what IFIS Publishing decided to develop and create is a one single platform where all regulatory information is available and accessible and questionable in one single place. Regulatory information is published in various places, different websites. Countries have several regulatory bodies. And to find that consistency of searching data is very, very difficult.
And also, Marta, it's written in ridiculous language that no one understands. It's so impenetrable.
Absolutely. And that's a very, very big challenge, even for us, because everything is published on the mother tongue. All law published in the official gazettes is in the official mother tongue. So the other big challenge that we have is providing that information, regulatory information, translated into what is regulatory readable data. So we don't provide consultancies, not what we do, but we have a platform, one single platform, where information is provided in a consistent manner.
And this is IFIS.
IFIS, International IFIS. Food Information Services.
Just so that are you targeting UK-based businesses, or is this actually global food businesses?
Global food businesses. Right. We've just come back from Brazil. Our two main subscribers are actually based in the US, so we've been a bit all over the world. So with our main product, which is called FSTA, Food Technology and Science Abstracts, which is nearly 50 years old, we've been collecting and collating academic papers, and we published abstracts for those academic papers. Mainly food science based. So everything that is to do with food, nutrition, ingredients, novel foods, that is all in FSTA.
If you're on the sort of site, you know, on the sort of table site, you do actually have to publish the ingredients, don't you? And whether and there's the allergens info. And, you know, I mean, that's before you even look at all the health and safety stuff.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Complex. So the health and safety stuff, there's two sides to it. So there's the production area, which we also cover on Escalex. So with Escalex, we wanted to make a product that covers pretty much all the regular content from farm to fork, as I said. So if it even talks about animal welfare, that is included on Escalex. The other thing we also have is a very intrinsic curation process, a bit like Kimberly. So we go through all the documents, almost page by page, and we select what is really, really relevant just to food. A good example, for instance, is in the US. There's a law or a code that is alcohol, firearms, and tobacco. Obviously, we're not interested in tobacco, we're not interested in firearms. So this curation process makes that selection. So we have a huge team based in India doing that curation process. Mm. And not only that, the way that we want to make Escalex available to users is to be able, for different levels of knowledge, being able to search the product and use the platform. And for that, we have different search lenses, what we call search lenses, where people can search and query the information in very, very different ways.
Yep, that's great. And again, you work for IFIS, and do you have a particular role there?
Yeah. So I'm the regulations and compliance executive. I work with Escalex, so I help with Marta here with the content, searching the different jurisdictions that we're adding to Escalex.
And Joanna, that means then if I've, you know, got a great product, mm-hmm. and we had the 10-acre guy with crisps last week, and he was saying, you know, you should be exporting to China, you should be doing, but presumably you've got to understand if there's any particular, you know.
Definitely.
So he was selling popcorn, I think, in China, and it's fine, he's probably, you know, sort of conforms to the law over here, suddenly he's in China, there might be some other things that that he has to conform to, and you can help them with that.
Yeah, so as Marta was saying, we don't offer consultancy, but our database, Escalex, gives you the tools to find out what you need to find out in that target country you're interested in. So it's really to help kind of small businesses, large corporates, academia as well, in finding the regulatory information and answers they need in a searchable and user-friendly way without going to all the different jurisdictions' websites, whether that's, you know, the FDA.
It sounds like pretty complex. I mean, I don't have a food product myself, so I'm not even sure the kind of information that I would need to go looking for. Would you be able to shed any light and give like a tangible example of what somebody might need to go and find on your platform, and then how that would help them?
I mean, I can give an example. When this product didn't exist, when we were looking at launching Table, there's a lot of work that went into building a marketplace solution, and nothing's available on off the shelf. So we had to spend a lot of time, and at the end, we were thinking, okay, we can have people self-certify, but what we need to be friendly and help them with the definitions. For instance, what is low fat, low sugar, etc. And we actually had to bring in an intern to spend 2 months compiling what all of those definitions meant, because they were in no one place.
You're not allowed to just say this is low fat.
Exactly.
Presumably you have to.
Oh, I mean,
there's a criteria.
Yeah,
there's
a criteria. In terms of packaging claims, yeah. I went to a fascinating talk a couple of weeks ago now, which was all about the legalities of food packaging. Mm. Sounds really boring, but it was actually really interesting. And some of the stuff that they were talking about in terms of putting health claims in particular on pack, and the allergen labeling and all that kind of stuff. And I guess if you don't know that stuff in advance, because you're not born with that kind of knowledge, you've got to go somewhere to find it out. And one of the things we talk about here a lot is how, the food industry and, running a food business is tough, because you've got all these different things to think about. But then you bring into it the legal side, and, you're making a physical thing that has to be safe, and, you've got all of this information to wade through. It's really, really challenging. So it's great that people like you, creating this.
I can give an example how the way we map the data, we can produce a list of things you need to look after when you are developing a new product or exporting to a different country. So we have, for instance, a product like condensed milk. Pretty much every country has legal requirements, compositional standards, marketing standards for sweetened condensed milk, for instance. But they might vary from country to country, whether to do with the compositional standards for the milk solids, so on and so forth. So by clicking on, looking for the definition, so I can start my search by looking, is there a legal definition of sweetened condensed milk in the United States of America? Mm-hmm. Fine. Yes, there is a compositional standard for sweetened condensed milk. I can then further my search using this platform to then clicking on an icon gives me a list of additives that I need to be aware that are permitted in sweetened condensed milk. Once I've got that,
very technical.
I know. Once I got that, I can also look for other requirements that are to just specific to sweetened condensed milk, whether it's hygiene standards, whether it's labeling standards that I need to be aware of, sweetened condensed milk. And yes, if I'm allowed to make health claims, because it's a voluntary stage, that is also included on Escalex. So it kind of gives you a way and a layered search where you can get all the information you need with a list of requirements that you need to be aware of before you
put it on.
But those are also changing. I mean, this stuff isn't stagnant, is it?
Yep.
So there's obviously, are you also trying to keep the people who are using your system up to date on changes in regulation?
Yeah, so as we were saying before, that regulations are always changing. It's kind of a moving landscape, so to speak. So we're trying our hardest to keep the user up to date with the most recent regulatory changes as well. So all the information on Escalex is updated on a kind of two-weekly basis to keep up to date with those changes. Whether that be, maximum permitted levels of additives or, amendments to legislation.
Just makes my head hurt.
And I can imagine this is going to get even more complex if the EU and British regulations divide, because currently I think they're matched one to one.
Pulling away from each other.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think Brexit is a huge concern for the food space, industry. Yeah. But in that sense, we're also looking into kind of a UK module as Brexit develops, because there will be UK-specific legislation as we leave the EU.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. So we launched in April this year. It's a brand new product. Mm. We work in partnership with an IT company based in Bangalore, and they have over 1,000 people just doing this intelligence of mapping of data.
Wow.
And out the way that even keywords, definitions work and have a relationship with
makes,
all different
makes
regulatory
great
documents.
British chefs look a bit small.
Tiny. We're all on tour.
And Brexit has been a big concern for not only in the UK, all around the world. Mm. So we, for launch, we decided to include or start up with five major big countries where the exports and imports are huge. So US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and EU harmonized law at the moment. And obviously now that we have the backbone and the structure, the concept of the product is much, much easier to include geographical coverage. So we'll be launching India, Malaysia, Singapore at the end of this year. We're also working on exploring the Asia markets, which are a big, big challenge. Mm-hmm. And they all mention UK. They're all concerned about the UK, especially where the marketing standards might change quite a lot. At the moment, we are pretty much one single country where there's no restrictions on the way we trade our food. But once we leave, absolutely.
Okay, so you're a not-for-profit charitable organisation, which is brilliant. And if anybody wants to find out more, it's ifis.org. And I'm guessing, really, if you are developing a new product, you really should be on there. You really must actually go and have a look at what you can and can't do. In the UK, that's not just if you're even remotely not even thinking about exporting, but you really do need to go on there. And also, I would hugely recommend Table, which is spelled TABL.com. Kimberly Heard, very, very much needed, I think, for our new startups.
Absolutely, and some delicious stuff on there.
Yeah, and there's some really good stuff in there. So good luck with that, Kimberly.
Thank you.
Yeah, make sure you go on there. And if you go onto the foodtalk.co.uk website, you'll find links to both those organisations. So thank you very much to Kimberly Heard of Table and Joanna Becker and Marta Cesar of IFIS. And good luck with it.
Thank you,
Sue.
Oh,
thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure.
So we're going to come back in the second half of the programme with Tessa Stewart, and we're just going to have a little break now. And you're back with us on the Food Talk Show. We've managed to shuffle out our previous guests, Kimberly, Joanna and Marta. So that's from Table and IFIS. And I'm absolutely delighted to have Tessa Stewart in the studio, who just knows so much. I'm going to be extracting loads out of your brain now for 36 minutes, Tessa. Do you want to just give us a little bit of your background? So how you started and what you actually do, because you're very much in demand.
Thank you very much. I mean, I couldn't have a better intro, could I, really?
Not really.
How will I ever live up to that? I work with food and drink brands, new and established, when they launch a new product onto the supermarket shelves and they want to know whether that's connecting with customers. It's a very expensive business to develop and launch a new product. Mm. And often they have to sit and wait for sales figures when there are things that they might be able to do around the branding which could make a difference to those early sales and hence their success on the shelf and hence their likelihood of staying in that retailer. So that's one of the things I do. I might also, if they are an established brand, I might look at new ideas that they have and I can test those in a mock-up. So for Oaxaca, they had a meal kit that they wanted to launch. They wanted to go up against Old El Paso, which is a huge brand, heavily promoted. And they sent me the empty mock-up meal kit packs, which they'd done in a very specific graphic style, which was very different from Old El Paso's sizzling fajitas and red and yellow. And I took those into Tesco New Malden. We put them on the shelves and I stood back just to see what shoppers would do. Because if you can get the shoppers to touch the packaging without any kind of intervention, then you know you've got a chance that it could work. Because you've got like less than 10 seconds when people are browsing the aisles, in some categories much less. And so if you can get something that attracts people that is sufficiently disruptive against the brands around it to attract their attention, make them pick it up, then you've got a very good start.
You see, I'm a designer by training, actually, a graphic designer. That's my first degree. And I used to do a lot of packaging as a designer. And you can learn all this stuff and you can learn all the theory. Mm-hmm. So we do colour theory, we do all sorts of other theories and whatever. And to this day, I've been doing marketing for 30, 35 years, to this day, it's still not a science. You can hone it down, you can do all sorts of stuff, but you still never know which one's going to take off and which isn't. You know, you can narrow it down by following all these design principles, but it's still about what is it? Is it the consumer's going to go for, and also the context of which that package is amongst all the rest of the things.
Yeah.
So even though these brands, these huge brands, will have, you know, expensive staff behind it, they'll have amazing people doing it, it still doesn't always guarantee success, does it?
Not at all. And I think one of the reasons that Oaxaca worked was that people already knew about the restaurants.
Mm.
So even if they hadn't been to them, Oaxaca had generated a good vibe, a good awareness in people, so that they knew the name. They might not know much that attached to it, but they might have had friends who'd been. And because they'd created that really good restaurant experience, that was going to carry over as a perception that people had that they could attach to a new brand when you see it. And of course, it worked really well for people who ever had been at Oaxaca and eaten there and had a good experience. They were like, yeah, I can do Oaxaca at home. Amazing.
But Tessa, how do you get a brand to be loved and cherished like that? And have a degree of, I don't know what the word is really.
Trust.
Loyalty and trust. Yeah. How do you do that? Is it everything surrounding it, not just the way it looks?
Well, I think if you look at someone like Pip and Nut, where the product, I think, is very good and is setting out to do something different and not use palm oil. So it's got an ethical platform at the beginning. It actually tastes very, very good. She's got stunning branding.
Yes, it's Pippa Murray. She's been on the show. It's lovely, isn't she?
It's beautiful. And she's very, very good at being the face of the brand and also doing social media around it and doing pop-ups. And she did Pipnics all last summer, where she popped up.
Brilliant concept,
A bit of yoga and a bit of hula hooping and all sorts of fun things. And the brand is incidental to that. But that, if you can get yourself in front of people. And I always think that the food business is an industry where you can't be shy. If you're shy, if you're shy, you're dead.
Yeah.
You know, sure. You really are. You are going to have to talk about your product over and over and over and over and over again. Yep. You're going to have to talk about your founder startup journey, which Pip does exceptionally well. In terms of being loved, I think the brands that are loved are the ones that you almost buy without thinking. So, for example, I'm a huge fan of Peter's Yard crisp breads.
Oh, wow.
I just really love them. And I love them because they don't have extra flavors and I can put them with my really expensive cheese and they're just a great platform and they don't crumble. You can load them up with loads of Stilton. And I think it's those things that end up being in your cupboard that you rely on, that you know will give you a good experience over and over again. And I think that's why Innocent did so well. And I worked with them in their early days, was when you drank an Innocent smoothie, you were in no doubt that you drank something different. It was fruity and delicious and fabulous and quite different from anything that was out there. And I think when you leave that message on people's taste buds, you've got quite a good chance that they might seek you out again, or they might remember you when they see you in the supermarket.
Mm. And Ollie, with Great British Chefs, you know, with your platform that you've got, you're representing different brands on there. Yep. And different chefs. Is it important as well to have a brand if you're a person and you're trying to push what you do? As well as, you know, a packaging brand as well. So I know you've worked at big food companies. Is it the same thing?
I think it is. I mean, I think in the end it boils down to the consistency of product and the consistency of messaging. And I think it, you know, whether you are a top chef or whether you are, you know, a really interesting food brand, you've got to make sure you've got a relevant story to tell that is consistently told through the experience. If you run a major restaurant and the first experience you have of walking through the door is terrible, you know, the meal is ruined. Yeah. In the same way, if you buy a great
brand,
if you buy a product and you open the packaging and it, you know, it looks awful at that point, you know, you're playing from a bad starting point. And I think the game in some ways is, and I think this is where at times large corporations kind of lose the plot, is, you know, you can destroy a brand really easily. I think these things are incredibly fragile. And I remember one of the last, you know, I suppose big jobs I did in the UK before I went on my travels with Unilever was migrating Jif to Cif. And it was one of the most kind of traumatic, you know, journeys that we went through.
Why did they do that? Is it a pronunciation thing abroad?
We did it. So that was the ad. So that was the ad. That was the ad story we told, which was that.
Because if you're in Scandinavia, presumably you're called Yif.
Well, that was the joke that JWT brilliantly came up with. And it was a fantastic, Low Lintas actually, came up with it. It was a brilliant idea. But, you know, when you do something like that, you shake a brand to its core. And I think that at times brand owners forget how often the things that you're doing are doing that, whether it's launching a new product, whether it's changing packaging, whether it's deciding where you're advertising, not advertising. You know, nowadays, you know, you're seeing advertising on, you know, certain platforms that a group of people don't like. It's very dangerous. And I think in the world of social media, people have the ability to talk back at you
It'll tell you, to create a movement
They'll against you. So I think it's...
Or for you. It does go both ways.
It does go both ways.
So it's very fragile.
I think that's part of the way we're all taking positions these days. I mean, you see it in politics. You see this thing about identity, and people seem to want to have an identity, and that can be defined by your food. So if you look at vegans, some of whom are quite... vociferous about the status of being vegan, and that's absolutely fine. But I think there's been a recent fracas with Root Health where they said something which seemingly offended the vegan community. And they all said, your sales will drop, no vegans will ever buy you. That hasn't actually happened. Their sales are fine. Of course, what it's done is gave the makers of publicity.
Dangerous game to play, though.
I don't think they were deliberately playing it. No. I think they genuinely were not intending to, you know, be offensive in any way. But I think there's a lot of talk around social media, and this will happen, that will happen. And actually, there's huge amounts of people who go out there and buy product and never are on social media. Great. It's one way of reaching people. The other way of reaching people is doing a promotion on shelf, which allows people to think, oh, you know what, I'll take a risk. And price promotion is one of the ways that people in Tesco say to me that they will come into a brand. It's expected that there will be a price promotion at some point, because that's what brands do.
That's what everybody does, isn't it? Everyone's like, you know, new sales are down. Let's, you know,
yeah. But what you're saying though is sometimes that's the trigger for somebody to make that first purchase on that brand they've never had. Yeah.
Because it's about risk. Right. So there you are, you're bumbling through your shopping, you're probably buying all your cozy familiar brands, you know you've got a good experience with them, you've had one before. So to be really disruptive and make you switch that pattern, the packaging's either got to say something like, this is going to be incredibly luxurious, or this is going to be better for your health, but it's got to cut through and you are still taking a risk. So what people say to me is, it's a big risk to switch. And you've got to get them to switch not once, but you've got to get them to switch over and over.
So what you're saying is then, I'm a mum, my kids, let's say my kids really like, I don't know, digestive biscuits. My husband really likes it, you know, something Marmite on his toast in the morning. And then there's a routine, there's an expectation. So for you to then come home and say, you know, you like digestives, kids, I've actually got you this instead. I mean, you know, they're going, well, what's going on? And what you're saying is to actually get people to change their behaviour is really tough.
Really tough.
But then to get them to continue to change their behaviour is... So if we take Pip and Nut, for example, you've been buying Sun Pat. Pip and Nut, presumably, it's got a price premium above that quite substantially.
Yeah.
You might go for that, but actually it's got to be that much better for you to take that chance. But then the taste is so amazing that you're just gonna forego that. You're gonna do it every time.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I asked a shopper. I was in the store doing some work for someone else, and I saw someone picking up Pip and Nut, and I couldn't resist saying to her, "Oh, that's fabulous! You know, why are you buying that?" And she said, "My daughter insists upon it."
Wow.
Tesla power.
And so to have developed that loyalty where you say to your mum, get me this brand, this is the brand I want. And this seems to be the role of mothers, to go out and buy particular brands.
From the child as well, not from the parent. I mean, the parent is making the initial buying decision. They're the ones with the money, I guess. Well, it depends on how old the child is, I guess. But that's really fascinating that it can be, you know, the brand loyalty is being instilled from such a young age.
Clever bit of marketing.
But I also think there's you know, not all consumers are equal, and there's a game you've got to play, which is, you know, not all, there are very few brands that start their infancy in Tesco's. They start their infancy in small shops, people like Table we were talking to earlier. And actually, you've got to try and create a kind of a movement, a groundswell amongst people who start to talk about these brands, because the first battle is fought way before you get a listing at Ocado or Waitrose or Tesco's. Tesco's is quite, you know, probably into £3-4 million turnover before you reach that level.
Yes, I'd agree. And I think, for example, Peter's Yard, one of their strengths is they went for independent delis and cheese shops. So it would be pretty rare now that you would walk into an independent deli or cheese shop and not see Peter's Yard in there. And that will protect them. So heaven forbid that they should ever be delisted from Waitrose or Sainsbury's, where they are as well, or Ocado. But they have a protected base of revenue from being in those independent shops and ubiquity.
And I also actually think, and we talk a lot to brands about this, is that the distribution in delicatessens and in specialist shops is brand building.
Completely
because
agree,
actually,
yeah.
it actually
it's so part of the brand.
It is.
So we're in this premium area, not you know.
But how do you distribute to delis though? Because they're so fragmented. I mean, surely that costs a fortune.
But that's
it's
where
quite
people
difficult.
Start, though. They all start in you know. There are lots of distributors that do that kind of work. But you know, if I take Barilla, who are, you know, one of our big partners and the world's largest pasta brand, is that actually you know they're not in certain retailers. And they are in people like Tesco's. But actually, it means people are picking Barilla up in Italian delicatessens because they know it's the number one pasta brand in Italy. So I think there's this sort of game where actually as brands build themselves, their distribution is part of their brand building strategy because it reinforces, you know, why what you're about.
And if I had a little bit of money and I'd you know started to you know, get a bit of traction, what, if I came to you, what would you be able to help me with, Tessa?
Probably not very much at the early stages, but I would direct you to my two books on Amazon, which are for startup food businesses, and say read those because those are going to tell you how to crack your first supermarket listing or Ocado.
My favourite of that is Flying Off the Shelves. It's the best one, I think. Yeah.
I will work with startups when they are very ambivalent about brand roots or they're worried about, well, could we say this as a health message? And they can send me over their PDFs of their design options and I can talk to them about, okay, well, in my experience of talking to consumers, these are the things that resonate and maybe you've got too many messages playing out on your packaging. So let's go with maybe two or three messages that you're really trying to get across. But the bulk of my work is really with bigger companies where they've got a critical time period to be in the supermarket and for it to work before they have to go back to the buyer.
Would this be a new product for them or sometimes a relaunch or what would it be typically?
It could be either of those things. So for Collective Dairy, I looked at, they were having problems with a particular flavour that they had, which was called Plain Jane. And it was the base of their yogurt, which is sweetened. And they'd launched it under the name Plain Jane. And it just wasn't working out. And they said,
dreadful name.
Can you go and talk to people about why it's not working out? Because it's not. And we've got a limited amount of time. We're going to have to say to the retailer why it's not selling like our other ones. So I went. And what happened was they'd taken cues that were blue and white that made it look like total yogurt, which is plain yogurt.
Yeah, yeah.
So the cues were telling people that was a plain yogurt. And so I went back to them and I said, you know, people have said to me in the supermarket, they have bought it and they were surprised that it was sweetened. So they changed the branding. They went with Sweet Jane. They made it very, very clear that it had honey in it. They changed the colour from blue and white to pink. And they say, what do you think happened to the sales as a result? And that was the only intervention that they made was to change the branding details.
But it's extraordinary that we're carrying around with us in our heads these connections with
cues.
Certain colours and these cues, you know, with, I don't know, particular objects or shapes or... But those are all inherent in people, aren't they? And that's why you've got to be so careful because people come with those biases in essence.
Well, that was a fascinating example. And their sales went up 50% after they'd done this. So they kept that particular recipe format on the shelf for a bit longer. But yeah, I mean, if we're walking down the supermarket aisle, if you sat there and thought, right, I'm really going to concentrate on choosing cornflakes today, and I'm going to choose between all the many brands that are there, you'd be there forever. You'd be there for a whole day doing your shopping. So we use shortcuts. You know, we know we like Kellogg's. We know that there's a Cockerel on it. We go for that. Your brain will just store these simple cues that help you navigate the aisles. And because we're lazy, we'll use those cues because it just helps us get through stuff faster. And so if you can work with those and you can think, right, okay, we'll use green because that says natural, then that's it's just going to help you. Because I always say to people, use colour and make sure that you've got strong colours that your brand owns. Think of Cadbury in purple.
They've sort of owned it, haven't
they? Think of Coke and red. So you want to build up a visual equity that starts to form in your shopper's mind so that when they go to the shelves again, they can find you.
You've developed a shortcut for them.
Exactly.
Now you've bought Naked Peanut Delight here. Why have you bought this? Can I have it? Because I'm starving.
Do you have any breakfast?
Explain to me. I haven't. Well, I have had breakfast, actually. Explain to me why you bought this with you.
I bought this because I think it's a really good example of a good snack that works well. You'll be lucky if you can get in there.
I can't open the blooming thing. Okay, but Naked is, for those that know, oh, thank you very much. For those that know, it's spelled N-A-K-D, and it's got a, what's that called?
Some kind of accent above the A.
Above the A. And is this one of your clients?
This is one of my clients, yeah.
And why have you bought this one in?
I bought this one in because I think it's a really good example of being clear about your packaging in a tiny little bar in a very competitive market. So there you are, you look at it and it says gluten, wheat and dairy free on the right hand side. It's really, really clear what it's got in, what it hasn't got in. And for these young vegans and vegetarians and free from people, that's very, very important. It tells you it's got peanuts in. It tells you it's going to delight you. I'm hoping Sue's delighted by it.
So is there, so when you do packaging, is there a hierarchy of things? So you say, right, I've got, I want to direct the consumer's eye, 1, 2, 3. You know, there's a hierarchy of how I want that to happen.
There is a hierarchy. And
can you manipulate that?
I think sometimes brands get obsessed with making their brand name absolutely huge on pack, when what the consumer will always say to me is, what is it?
They want to know what's in it,
what
not
is the product?
What it's called.
Yeah,
what is it? And what do I do with it? Mm. Now, the brand will have devised their name and been very pleased with it and come up with it. And sometimes they just give it a bit too much space on pack when actually you've got people who are really fretting about it. I mean, I researched Mama's Bertram Muesli a while back and people didn't know what Bertram Muesli was. So you needed to tell them more about what it was because they just said, oh, my God, it's oats in cold yogurt. How would that ever be nice? You know, so I think sometimes you've got to help people if it's not a very familiar idea and just think about that balance. And also things like, well, putting delight on this packaging where it says peanut delight. You're already thinking, peanuts, delight, what will that taste like? You're already getting the taste buds going. Mm.
Tastes very good, if anyone's wondering.
It'd be great if you could mention...
Thank you, Guy.
Yeah, it'd be great if you could mention a name, but I'd understand if you can't. What's the most disastrous thing that you've seen out there in terms of packaging? Dreadful. Come on.
I'll give you a second to think about this for a second.
When I was at
Unilever, it wasn't a project I was involved with, but... they relaunched Finesse in North America.
And what they that?
Finesse, cotton. It's another one shampoos. Of Unilever's average shampoos.
Okay.
And essentially, it completely bombed. And they changed every color on the packaging. They literally went from like a well-known purple, I forget the exact colors, to something else. And it destroyed the brand overnight. They literally went from like a 12% share to a 2% share. And the guy who ran it, was a lovely guy, actually then launched Axe across North America, which is one of Unilever's most successful launches. And he actually had on his laptop to this day, when we were out there, he had that packaging as a reminder of how easy it is to get things horribly wrong. Mm. And I think it's that thing, is if you literally throw out, if you have a brand with an incredible amount of heritage and you throw out a load of built-in equity, you can destroy a brand. I think at times... I think the packaging disasters that are most famous are the ones where people go, we're going to move beyond the...
Whatever.
And whatever it is. And then it's actually not moving beyond. It is literally removing the core visual cue
visual cues.
That people are using. And people are going, it's obviously not sold here anymore. Yeah. I'll be spicing up.
And is that because there's just so little time that people give themselves to do those things? I mean, they're not going to stand and look for it, are they?
I know a brand recently, which I'm not going to name, where they had a very expensive rebrand. And that was exactly what happened. People got in touch with them and said, hang on, you seem to have vanished from the store, can't find you. These were loyal customers. Mm. Where have you gone? Because it was not an evolution, it was a revolution, and they'd just gone too far. And it was not a good thing to do, in my view.
I went to see Wensleydale Creamery. I don't know if you know them. They're in Hawes, up north somewhere. Make the most beautiful cheese. Got a great farm shop there. Lots of employees, you know, growing and growing and growing. And then they got the sort of license, is it, for Wallace and Gromit because of Wensleydale.
Okay.
So they were really excited
about
this.
Oh, the rights to use it
as
branding in store.
And they put that on some of their packaging and it was a disaster. It nearly ruined the company because actually what it did was downgrade in the public's eyes that somehow it wasn't as good a cheese or whatever because it was associated with... And actually, of course, the sales impact was dreadful because it didn't, you know, the sort of allegiance to Wallace and Gromit, who we all love, didn't then transfer as an adult, is seen like a sort of children's cheese.
Mm. Almost looks like they're trying too hard to sell it.
So you have to be incredibly careful, don't you, about the marketing decisions that you make. I mean, you know, and on the face of it, you'd think that would really help them, but actually it's taken them a long time to recover so that everybody realises they are an amazing cheese brand.
Well, I think Wallace and Gromit wasn't just about any cheese. I mean, it wasn't about quality cheese. It was just about any consumption of any cheese,
Wensleydale,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
But, I mean, you look at people like Yorkshire Tea, who are very proud of their sort of regional heritage, and that works very well for them. But it's a very clearly defined brand. I don't think the packaging has changed for a long, long time, so you can easily see it. You know, and that is kind of what you need. I mean, there are new brands coming in who sort of take almost an anti-packaging style.
So what have you got in front of us here? Is it something else I can eat?
Yes, of course.
I'm really hungry this morning.
So this is Brave Foods. They've just launched. They'll be in places like As Nature Intended. Open that up soon. Tell me what you think. Okay, so I love it. I think it's a really
Brave on the outside. As you said, it's a huge name. So the name's taking up half the packaging, but I don't know what Brave is. And then on the right-hand side, it says roasted peas, sea salt, naturally high in protein and fibre. And it's very jolly, isn't it? It's very jolly and fun type of packaging. Are you pleased with this?
I think it's brilliant. I mean, I have to say I'm addicted to the product because I think they've actually made a really, really good product here. So I'm kind of buying them every week. But I love the way they've taken British split peas and combined them with sea salt and roasted them and made that into a snack. Because so many snacks are not good for you and are heavily processed. And I just think this minimal approach, which is great for vegans, I just think they're great.
So it's like wasabi peas, but without the wasabi.
Yeah, yeah.
And split peas instead of whatever.
They do fill you up. So rather than having a packet of crisps.
I don't think I like them.
Do you not like them?
No.
Oh, they're great.
Do you?
I eat everything. Do
anything, you do eat everything.
I'm just eating someone here now.
Are they your cup of tea? No, look at him, look.
I mean, I think they're fine. I mean, they're not. for me, give me a wasabi pea any day of the week. I mean, like, I want that kind of like, poof.
There's kind of paprika version you might like better.
Ollie doesn't like anything unless it blows his head off. Well, that's well established.
The problem.
This is one of the things with guys. They have taste buds that like a salt, whereas women have supposedly more taste buds and are more subtle.
I spent too much time eating curry. That's the problem.
A question that springs to mind when we look at a package like this, which has got a very large brand name on it and a very small description of what it is, would you say that that's a good tactic when you are an unknown brand that no one's heard of the name and you want that to kind of sit in somebody's mind? Or is it more important to talk about the product and what someone's going to get?
I would talk more about the product and what someone's going to get, really. Because I think people want to know, and
especially if you're new,
I think people get very bored with, oh, let's talk about our brand now, you know, and
because most people don't care,
you know, they really don't. it's all about when you buy a new product, it's about what's in it for me. So I'm really picky about my snacks. I hardly buy any. I'm not really a snacky girl, but sometimes I do just crave something before I cook dinner, and these Brave peas are it. I mean, I love it, and they've got me. Because it just feels nice and I don't like heavily processed stuff.
It's such a difficult fine line, though, because on one hand you have to build a brand, and on the other hand, as you said, that people in general, you know, I mean, I think people do have loyalty, but, you know, once it stretches too far, you know, I think people inherently are disloyal. They'll try new things, and to keep somebody loyal is quite difficult.
And you won't. People will move around and, you know, I think brands have to accept that on some level that people will come and go. But, you know, I think the great thing about the food space, and this is what, you know, kind of makes it probably more forgiving, and say the car space or other, being a football team, whatever, is that actually there are lots of eating occasions. And you only need to be in one of those eating occasions. Mm. And, you know, the more a person is into the world of food and stuff and they're cooking from home, then if that is targeted at the pre-dinner drinks moment, you know,
but you say that, Ollie. I mean, you know, Marmite has been around for decades and decades and decades. People are really loyal to that. maybe that's because there isn't an alternative. I don't know really. Well, there's Vegemite, I guess, but but it's things like tomato ketchup, and there's very particular brands. I think there is quite a lot of loyalty to, but there's not many. I mean, very few and far between.
But both those some, examples are brands some. With moments that are probably declining. You know, you could argue that certainly one of the things we're looking at in our research in January is the growth of global food in the UK. Mm. And actually, if you look at foodies, most of them are not cooking what they are defining as British food most of the time. Mm. Now, that means, yes, you can use tomato ketchup in other cuisines. But ultimately, the threats come from lots of places. You know, are people having the toast moment? Less so now. They're eating out for breakfast more. You know, so yes, these are brands that own spaces. But I think the challenge is beyond owning spaces. It's actually about cultural relevancy and making sure that your brand keeps addressing a relevant moment in people's lives. And I think, you know, the world of food shifts so much, whether it's regulation, whether it's the sugar tax coming in, whether it's concerned about health and wellness, the emergence of Brexit, all this stuff. I mean, you know, brands are moving on a massive moving playing field where threats come literally from nowhere.
Yeah, they do. They really come from nowhere. And I was thinking my client unearthed the rise in people going to Spain. Unearthed are in Waitrose and they make olives and jamon and charcuterie and nice things like that. Now, they said to me, can you go and find out what's going on? Because we're finding that in young upscale Sainsbury's, our sales are really high. What's happening? I went in there and found that young mums were feeding their kids olives and ham on after school, which you just wouldn't think. Now, the reason they're doing that is they've all been to Spain. Maybe dad's got really into cooking paella. Maybe they have Spanish meals on the weekend. Where has that come from? That's a huge global influence that's just swept in and is benefiting, is benefiting Unearthed. You know, because people have changed their habits. So it's not a chocolate biscuit after school, it's some olives. Mm. Who would have thought it?
And so, ham on. I like that addition.
Amazing.
And
but,
ham on.
Had you had me olives, I'd have been like, yeah, but the ham on.
Ham on.
I mean, I do know whenever my son gets a chance to grab some of the, you know.
He does.
Yeah. Mm.
And Tessa, sort of finally, we've got about 5 or 6 minutes left. Do you think that the big brands now are under threat? Are they feeling that there's so many amazing food things that are happening? So many people want to take stuff out of food now and make it as pure as possible. Do you think that is hurting them at all?
Well, I think the more small food brands you have, the more they whittle away. They are taking away a base that those big brands had. I mean, I have recently worked with Unilever and they were trying to work in a more innovative and youthful and startup kind of way to develop a product.
They do that every 2 years.
Yeah. This one's launching into Whole Foods, though, in January, sure. So we did get there. Mm-hmm. So I think their whole mindset really is about avoiding risk, avoiding failure internally, whereas a startup will be more risky inherently because people... they're just going out there and they're doing it for the hell of it. Can I do this? And I think that just makes people braver. It makes them get sales. It makes them get into stores because they have to. They haven't got a choice. They've taken their life savings and they're doing this.
But if you extrapolate that, do you think that the age of the big brand where there used to be, you know, literally a handful of huge producers who owned all the brands or literally on the shelves around the supermarkets, do you think that's waning significantly?
Well, remember that they still have the relationships with the supermarkets. Mm. They can still buy the space on the shelf. They can still afford because they've engineered their products to allow them to spend a lot on marketing. Whereas your startup with a very beautiful food won't have that additional spend. They won't be able to run the promotions. They won't have that incredible awareness that those big brands have built up. So, yeah, they're under threat. They're under threat more from changing food habits. Mm. So veganism.
And not keeping up quick enough.
Moving to plant-based foods, which I think has caught brands on the hop. So you see Unilever buying Pucker herbs, herbal drinks.
Is that because they can't innovate quickly enough internally, therefore they have to go and buy a company that does?
Well, it's much less risky.
Yeah, especially. Yeah.
You know, they can just buy an established client base.
The brand is already built,
The time it takes to build something from scratch. And also, the truth of the matter is, if you are a Unilever team trying to build a brand, the cost base that you work off, even if you had 20 people working in a startup versus 20 people at Unilever, the cost base is probably 5 times higher based on the rent, pensions, everything that goes with it, the structures, everything. And they're driven by different motivations. Mm. You know, I worked in innovative parts of Unilever, and your motivations are different to when you, you founded your own thing.
Yeah, of course.
And I think that the shopping habits are changing at the moment, and I think we're certainly seeing...
Do you think people are avoiding the supermarkets I think
supermarkets have a role. You know, it's where I buy, you know, our Dove. You know, it's where you buy your Fairy. It's where you buy those
kind of... I was going to say, it's where I buy my non-food stuff, actually.
Well, you buy some food stuff there, like, you know, like I pick up, you know, the Peter's Yard or, I don't know, the Stock Cubes or Barilla, whatever happens to be. You know, there are things that you buy there, but then you are then layering it with what I call the more interesting brands through farmers markets, delicatessens, butchers, fishmongers, etc. And I think, you know, the growth in that area is just blowing it off. And I think as you get more and more global cuisines coming through, people need to go to specialist outlets in order to get the ingredients to cook these things.
Sure. Last word to you, Tessa's running out of time. Predictions for the future for some of these big brands or any trends you're seeing?
Trends, more plant-based, definitely. I think it's become mainstream. I mean, 25% of the UK's vegans are in London now. If you're launching a vegan brand, launch it in London first. Launch it in London first because London is more affluent. People will try more things. And going out for dinner and trying new foods is actually built into young people's culture in London. Mm. I think that's maybe not so much the case elsewhere. London is just very, very forward thinking. I think plant-based and start in London. I think that's what I'd say.
And food as medicine? In inverted commas, as in people trying to, you know, add extra protein, do these, you know, really trying to, you know, younger people really trying to some of that stuff out.
The next thing that's going to hit is gut health.
Yeah.
And if you listen to Tim Spector, who's the authority on this, he will just say, eat a wide variety of fermented things, eat lots of different cheeses, eat sourdough. So things that are naturally processed, naturally fermented and arising. So I think that takes you away from processed functional foods, which by their very nature are processed.
We heard that, didn't we, on Food Matters Live, that people were saying that fermented foods are going to be huge, big.
We've had people on the show in the past who are talking about gut health. I think it was one that I missed, actually, but I listened back to recently.
Yeah, absolutely. So gut health is everything. Mm, okay. Well, Tessa Stewart... actually, your website, tessastewart.co.uk, it tells everybody all about what you do. And Stewart is spelled S-T-U-A-R-T. And certainly I've seen some of the stuff. And whenever I've been to events, when you're on, people are absolutely crammed in the rooms. They're all down the corridor. They won't let you in. It's very... if Tessa's speaking anyway, it's definitely worth going to listen. Because if you are starting up a brand... understanding how all that works and how people are choosing things and what's going through their mind is important, isn't it? Gives you a little bit of an edge in terms of success, don't you think?
Well, do join me at the Enterprise Nation webinar on the 9th of January. Then I'll take you through the secrets of how brands succeed.
Yeah, the secrets. You've been listening to the Food Talk Show. We're now syndicated to dozens of radio stations across the UK and further afield from California to the Kent coast. Thank you to my fellow presenters, Guy Routledge of The Food Rush. Thank you very much, Guy.
Thank you very much, Sue.
And nice to have you back in the studio.
Nice to be back.
Yes, Ollie Lloyd from Great British Chefs. And starting off the new year with The Food Talk Show. So we all wish you a fantastic 2018. Don't forget you can get in touch with us by Twitter on @FoodTalkShow or go onto our website. There's hundreds of podcasts on there now at foodtalk.co.uk, and have a good week. Bye.